Chapter 2. Time is money? Time is money. Another central dimension in the hacker's peculiar way of working is their relation to time. Linux, the net, and the personal computer were not developed in an office between the hours of 9 and 5. When Torvalds programmed his first versions of Linux, he typically worked late into the night and then woke up in the early afternoon to continue. Sometimes he shifted from coding Linux to just playing with the computer, or to doing something else entirely. This free relation to time has always been typical of hackers who have appreciated an individual rhythm of life. In his famous essay, Weber emphasized the organic connection between the concepts of work and time by incorporating a particular sense of time in his concept of the Protestant work ethic. He quotes Benjamin Franklin's slogan, "Time is money," which resonates with the teachings of Protestant clergymen such as Richard Baxter. "Keep up a high esteem of time, and be every day more careful that you lose none of your time than you are that you lose none of your gold and silver." The spirit of capitalism arose out of this attitude to time. When we think about the network society's dominant relation to time, it is obvious that even though our new economy differs in many other respects from the old industrial capitalism, it largely follows the precepts of the Protestant ethic in regard to the optimization of time. Now, ever shorter units of time are money. In his epilogue, Manuel Castells aptly speaks about the network society's trend of time compression. Optimize time. No one can avoid experiencing the consequences of this optimization of time. The way that our business news is presented is a good cultural indicator of how time pulsates ever more intensely for us. The background music for CNBC's economic news has become more frenetic than that on MTV, and in its speedy visual aesthetics, it surpasses those of music videos. Even if one did not understand any of the actual content of the news, one would get the message that there is reason to hurry. Also, without understanding the meaning of the news itself, one can realize that it is this speedy economy, the presentation of which on the business news shows follows the same format as weather reports, that regulates the pace of our actions. In both, we are informed about weather conditions to which we simply have to adjust. Sunny in New York and a pleasant plus 80 NASDAQ degrees, typhoon and gain warnings in Tokyo. In his work, The Information Age, Castells has demonstrated empirically how competition intensifies in the global information economy. Speedy technological changes make it imperative to get new technology to consumers quickly, before one's competitors do. The slow are left holding obsolete products. Even worse is a belated response to the fundamental shifts in technology. Excellent examples of this culture of speed are Amazon.com, Netscape, and Dell Computer, present media symbols of the new economy. Jeff Bezos, a broker who turned into the founder of the web store Amazon.com, explains the importance of keeping up with technological advance. When something is growing 2,300% a year, as was the net at the time of Amazon.com's founding, you have to move fast. A sense of urgency becomes your most valuable asset. Jim Clark, whose second of the $3 billion companies he founded was Netscape, describes his flight from Illinois, where the Mosaic browser was created by Marc Andreessen and others, back to Silicon Valley after he realized the opportunity offered by the web. The clock was ticking. Even the 3.5-hour flight from Illinois to San Francisco was lost time. Next to the law of constantly increasing acceleration, Moore's law, with its 18-month increments, seemed almost leisurely. According to Intel founder Gordon Moore, the efficiency of microprocessors doubles every 18 months. In a lot less time than that, we had to make a whole new product, get it on the market. People weren't going to think in the 18-month periods of Moore's law anymore. That was now an eon. but in how fast light moved down a fiber optic cable. Clark's law of continuous acceleration compels programs to be released faster and faster. The capital of successful entrepreneurs in the field also has to move much faster than ever before. Investments frequently change targets within hours, minutes, or even seconds. Capital must not be allowed to stagnate in warehouses or surplus personnel. It must be ready for quick investment in technological innovation or in constantly switching targets in the financial markets. Time compression has now proceeded to a point where technological and economic competition consists of promising the future to arrive at the consumer faster than it would by the competitor's mediation. New technological inventions are marketed with the claim that they bring us the future already. Correspondingly, in the economic field, no one is content to grow wealthy by waiting for the future, which is why the net companies gain tremendous present worth in record time, long before the realization of their expectations for the future. In this world of speed, a quick change in weather conditions, e.g., lateness in regard to a technological shift or surprising fluctuation in the financial market, can cause problems even for excellent enterprises, forcing them to lay off even people who have performed their work superbly. Sunshine has turned suddenly to rain. In order to adjust to these quick changes and accelerated techno-economical competition, enterprises have adopted more agile modes of operation. First, agility is gained by networking. In his epilogue, Manuel Castells describes the rise of the network enterprise. Network enterprises concentrate on their core skills and forge networks according to their changing needs with subcontractors and consultants. It takes too long to acquire every skill oneself, and extra personnel can become a slowing burden later. Network enterprises are even willing to enter project-based alliances with their competitors while continuing otherwise to be energetic rivals. Even internally, network enterprises consist of relatively independent units working together on various projects. People are employed in ways that are more flexible than in the permanent employment model. Castells calls them flex workers. The network model makes it possible for an enterprise to employ only the personnel required for the projects of the moment, which means that in the new economy, the real employers are not the enterprises per se, but the projects between or within them. Second, operations in the network society are speeded up by optimization of processes, which is sometimes also called re-engineering, after management thinker Michael Hammer's influential Harvard Business Review article, Re-Engineering, Don't Automate, Obliterate, 1990. Adapting to the new economy does not simply mean adding a web page to an old process. It involves a rethinking of the entire process. After the change, the process may consist of entirely new stages, but even when that is not the case, all unnecessary intermediate stages are dropped, and the stopping of products at warehouses is minimized or eliminated. In the culture of speed, immobility is even worse than slowness. And third, automation, already familiar from industrial society, is still important. It is revealing that news releases about high-tech businesses, such as Dell, still often show people at an assembly line. Once a process has been optimized, its parts must still be speeded up by automation. Sometimes process optimization and automation proceed in a reverse order, which can easily lead only to the faster accomplishment of unnecessary or even completely wrong tasks. Even high-tech industry still requires material production, but in it, human beings are assigned as minimal roles as possible, and they are taught how to perform this in the most time-saving way. So, Taylorism, the time optimization method developed by Frederick Winslow Taylor for industrial capitalism, is still alive in the network society. From the typical information professional of our time, symbolized by a technology company's manager, engineer, or graphic artist, This culture of speed demands an ever more effective use of his or her working hours. The working day is chopped up into a series of fast appointments, and he or she has to hurry from one to the next. Constantly threatened by some tight project deadline, the professional has no time left for playfulness and must optimize his or her schedule in order to stay on top of it all. The Fridayization of Sunday. The old Protestant ethics work-centeredness already meant that there was no time for play and work. This ethics apotheosis in the new economy can be seen in the fact that the ideal of time optimization is now being extended even to life outside the workplace, if such life still exists. The optimizing pressures on working life, or Friday, if we use the allegories proposed in Chapter 1, are now so strong that they begin to eliminate the other pole of the Protestant ethic, the playfulness of free time or Sunday. After the working life has been optimized to its fullest, the requirement of optimality is extended to all of one's other activities too. Even in time off, one is no longer free merely to be. One has to perform one's being especially well. For example, only a beginner relaxes without having taken a class in relaxation techniques. To be just a hobbyist in one's hobbies is considered embarrassing. First, playfulness was removed from work. Then, playfulness was removed from play, and what is left is optimized leisure time. In his book, Waiting for the Weekend, Witold Rybczynski provides a good example of the change. People used to play tennis. Now they work on their backhand. It is appropriate that the first person known to no longer merely play tennis, but systematically work on his backhand, was none other than Frederick Taylor. To this end, he even designed a special racket and won the U.S. Men's Doubles Championship in 1881. Another work-centered way to spend leisure is to engage in the practice of skills important to work, or else to detach oneself as optimally as possible from work in order to be able to continue it in the best possible shape. In an optimized life, leisure time assumes the patterns of work time. Home time is scheduled and planned as tightly as work time. Take child to sports practice, 5:30 to 5:45. Gym, 5:45 to 6:30. Therapy session, 6:30 to 7:20. Pick up child from practice, 7:20 to 7:35. Prepare food and eat, 7:35 to 8 o'clock. Watch television with family, 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock. Put child to bed. Converse with spouse, 11 o'clock to 11:30. Watch late night show, 11:30 to 12:30. Other attention paid to spouse, occasionally, 12:30 to 12:45. The day is divided on a business model in clear-cut segments of time, and that division is, of course, reinforced by the program schedules of television. The time spent at home is often experienced in a way similar to the way time at work is experienced, rushing from one appointment to another so that one manages to keep them all. Aptly, one mother explained to an interviewer how she felt that the families now have a new status symbol. It used to be a house or a car. Now you say, "You're busy. You should see how busy we are." In Time Bind, sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild gives an excellent description of the extent to which the home has started using business methods to optimize time. Hochschild does not examine these changes in the home in relation to the new economy, but it is easy to place these changes in their larger context by regarding them as adaptations of the three forms of time optimization used in business life. The home, too, has been tailorized or automated to make the human being's task as simple and as quickly performable as possible. Hochschild speaks aptly of de-skilling parents at home. Microwavable prepared foods have replaced homemade dinners based on personal recipes. Families no longer create their own entertainment, but simply punch the remote to tune themselves into television's social assembly line. Hochschild's irony is accurate. After dinner, some families would sit together, mute but cozy, watching sitcoms in which television mothers, fathers, and children talked energetically to one another. In home life management, another business strategy comes into play. Networking, especially in the form of outsourcing from takeout food to daycare centers, subcontracting food production, and child care. Hochschild gives a good description of the resultant new image of the mother or father. The time-starved mother is being forced more and more to choose between being a parent and buying a commodified version of parenthood from someone else. By relying on an expanding menu of goods and services, she increasingly becomes a manager of parenthood, supervising and coordinating the outsourced pieces of familial life. Third comes the optimization of process. Even at home, the process of childcare is optimized by eliminating its unnecessary parts. No longer do parents just hang out inefficiently with the children. They spend quality time with them. This quality time is clearly defined in terms of its beginning and end, and in the course of it some event clearly takes place or some concrete outcome is achieved, e.g. the child's school play or athletic contest, or a trip to the amusement park. In quality time, all downtime is minimized or obliterated. A parent who has completely internalized the culture of speed may even believe that the child, too, experiences this as equal to or even better than a relationship in which the adult has unconditioned time for the child. Hochschild comments, "Quality time holds out the hope that scheduling intense periods of togetherness can compensate for an overall loss of time in such a way that a relationship will suffer no loss of quality." Flexible time. In the new economy, all of life has become more optimized in a way typical, and in former time not even typical, of work. But this is not all. In addition to the work-centered optimization of time, the Protestant ethic also means the work-centered organization of time. The Protestant ethic introduced the idea of regular working time as the center of life. Self-organization was lost and relegated to a region of work's leftovers. The evening as what's left of the day, the weekend as the remainder of the week, and retirement, the leftovers of life. At the center of life is the regularly repeated work, which organizes all other uses of time. Weber describes how, in the Protestant ethic, irregular work, which the ordinary laborer is often forced to accept, is often unavoidable, but always an unwelcome state of transition. A man without a calling lacks the systematic, methodical character which is demanded by worldly asceticism. Once again, Weber finds this doctrine in the text of Protestant preachers such as Richard Baxter, according to whom a good worker will carry out his work in order, whereas another remains in constant confusion, and his business knows neither time nor place. So far, this organization of time has not changed a lot in the new economy. Few still can deviate from strictly regular working hours, despite the fact that the network society's technologies not only compress time, but also make it more flexible. Castells calls this the desequencing of time. With technologies like the net and the mobile phone, one can work where and when one wants. But this new flexibility does not automatically lead to a more holistic organization of time. In fact, the dominant development in the new economy seems to be that flexibility is leading to the strengthening of work-centeredness. More often than not, the information professionals use flexibility to make leisure time more available for brief spells of work than the other way around. In practice, the block of time reserved for work is still centered on an at least 8-hour workday. But leisure time is interrupted by spells of work. Half an hour of television, half an hour of email, half an hour outside with the kids, interspersed with a couple of work-related mobile phone calls. Wireless technology, such as the mobile phone, is not in itself a technology of freedom. It can be a technology of reacting to emergencies as well. It easily happens that every call turns into an urgent call, and the mobile phone becomes a tool for surviving the day's emergencies. Against this background, there is appropriate irony in the fact that the first adopters of the phone, both landline and radio, were emergency professionals, such as policemen who needed to respond to urgent situations. Aronson and Greenbaum describe how, for example, wired doctors gradually but steadily assumed the moral obligation to be reachable by telephone at all times. Even to the larger audience, the phone was originally marketed as a survival tool. A 1905 advertisement described how the phone can save a lonely housewife's life. "The modern woman finds emergencies robbed of their terror by the telephone. She knows she can summon her physician, or, if need be, call the police or fire department in less time than it ordinarily takes to ring for a servant." Another marketing point was that a businessman could call his wife that he is late because of some urgent matter. In a 1910 advertisement, a man says to his wife, "I'll be half an hour late." And the wife replies cheerfully, "All right, John." The text below the picture explains further. "Unexpected happenings often detain the businessman at his office. With a Bell telephone on his desk and one in his home, he can reach his family in a moment. A few words relieve all anxiety." Since the first words on the phone by its inventor, Alexander Graham Bell, to his assistant in 1876, "Mr. Watson, come here, I want you," the phone has been linked to a culture of urgency. The paradox is that the highest technology brings us easily to the lowest level of survival life, in which we are constantly on call, reacting to urgent situations. There is a strong tendency in this direction in the new economy elite's image. In the past, you belonged to the elite when you no longer had to run from one place to the next, working all the time. Nowadays, the elite consists of people perennially on the move, taking care of urgent business on their mobile phones and always trying to survive some deadline. The Sundayization of Friday. If we use the new technology to further work-centeredness, technologies such as the mobile phone easily lead to a work-centered dissolution of the boundary between work and leisure. Both the optimization and flexibility of time may lead to Sunday becoming more and more like Friday. But this is not inevitable. Hackers optimize time to be able to have more space for playfulness. Torvald's way of thinking is that, in the middle of the serious work of Linux development, there always has to be time for some pool and for some programming experiments that do not have immediate goals. The same attitude has been shared by hackers since the MIT of the 60s. In the hacker version of flex time, different areas of life, such as work, family, friends, hobbies, etc., are combined less rigidly, so that work is not always at the center of the map. A hacker may join his friends in the middle of the day for a long lunch, or go out with them for a beer in the evening, then resume work late in the afternoon or the next day. Sometimes he or she may spontaneously decide to take the whole day off to do something completely different. The hacker view is that the use of machines for the optimization and flexibility of time should lead to a life for human beings that is less machine-like, less optimized and routine. Raymond writes, "To behave like a hacker, you have to believe this, that people should never have to drudge at stupid repetitive work, enough to want to automate away the boring bits as much as possible, not just for yourself, but for everybody else." When the hacker ideal of more self-determined use of time becomes realized, Friday, the work week, should become more like what Sunday, the leftovers of life, has traditionally been. Historically, this freedom to self-organize time has an important precursor in the academy. The academy has always defended a person's freedom to organize time oneself. Plato defined the academic relation to time by saying that a free person has skull, that is, plenty of time. When he talks in peace and quiet, and his time is his own. But skull did not mean just having time, but also a certain relation to time. A person living an academic life could organize one's time oneself. The person could combine work and leisure in the way that he wanted. Even though a free person could commit to certain works, no one else owned his time. Not having this charge of one's time, askolia, was associated with the state of imprisonment, slavery. In the pre-Protestant life, even outside of the academy, people were more in charge of their time than after the Protestant Reformation. In his book, Montaigu, Cathars and Catholics in a French Village, 1294 to 1324, Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie creates a fascinating portrait of life in a medieval village at the turn of the 13th and 14th centuries. The villagers had no way to define time in any exact way. When they spoke of it, they used vague expressions, saying that something had happened at the season when elms have put forth their leaves, or that something took the time it takes to say two paternosters. In Montaigu, there was no need for more exact time measurements, since the village was not run according to any regular working time. Leroy Ladurie writes, "The people of Montaigu were not afraid of hard work and could make an effort if necessary, but they did not think in terms of a fixed and continuous timetable. For them, the working day was punctuated with long, irregular pauses, during which one would chat with a friend, perhaps at the same time enjoying a glass of wine." "At those words," said Arnaud Sicre, "I folded up my work and went to Guillemette Maury's house." And Arnaud Sicre indicates several other similar interruptions. "Pierre Maury sent for me in the shop where I made shoes. Guillemette sent a message to ask me to go to her house, which I did. Hearing that, I left what I was doing." In Montaigu, it was still, to a great extent, the worker and not the clock that determined the pace. Nowadays, a shoemaker who decided to go off and have a glass of wine with a friend in the middle of the day would be fired, no matter how many shoes he produces and how excellently. This is because the workers of our time no longer enjoy the same freedom to manage their own time a cobbler or shepherd enjoyed in the dark Middle Ages. Of course, no picture of medieval work is complete without mentioning that there was also land slavery. But if we allow this important exception, we can say about the medieval work that as long as reasonable goals were met, no one supervised the worker's use of time. Only in monasteries was activity tied to the clock. Once again, the Protestant ethics' historical precedent can be found in the monastery. In fact, when reading the monastic rules, one often feels that one is reading a description of the dominant contemporary company practices. Benedict's rule is a good example. It taught that life's pattern must always be repeated at the same hours in just the same way. These hours were the seven canonical office hours. Dawn, Lauds, Laudis. 9 a.m., Prime, Prima. Noon, Sext, Sexta. 3 p.m., Nun, Nona. 6 p.m., Vespers, Vespera. Nightfall, Compline, Completorium, the completion of the day. At night, Matins, Matutine. The canonical hours circumscribed the time for all activities. Following them, wake-up time was always the same, as was bedtime. Compline was followed by silence and sleep. Work and study were also assigned exact hours, Under Benedict's rule, deviation from the schedule set for life was a punishable act. Oversleeping was condemned.
Let every precaution be taken that this does not occur.
No one was allowed to take a break for a self-decided snack.
Let no one presume to take food or drink before or after the appointed time.
Appropriately, whoever misses the beginning of the sacred office hours is punished punctually at certain clock times.
Then, at all the hours when the work of God is ended, let him cast himself on the ground in the place where he standeth, and thus let him make satisfaction, until the abbot again biddeth him finally to cease from this penance.
The only exception to the demand for absolute promptness in regard to office hours was the night prayer, to which one could arrive at any time until the reading of the second psalm, a staggered work hour. The Protestant ethic brought the clock out of the monastery and into everyday life, giving birth to the concept of the modern worker and the notions of workplace and work time associated with it. After that, Franklin's words in his autobiography applied to all. Every part of my business should have its allotted time. Despite its newness, the new economy is still predominantly based on office hours, with no place for individual variations. This is a strange world, and the shift to it did not take place without strong resistance. In his article, Time, Work Discipline, and Industrial Capitalism, 1967, social historian Edward Thompson characterizes interestingly the difficulties encountered in the transition to industrial work. He notes that the medieval agriculturists, for example, were used to task-oriented work. In their traditional thinking, the essential thing was to complete their tasks. The weather set exterior limits, but within these, tasks could be dealt with according to individual inclination. Industrial work, on the other hand, was time-oriented. Work was defined by the time used for it. It was this idea of defining a work relation with time, and not some works that pre-industrial people found alien, and they resisted it. The interesting promise of the new information technology is that it could make a new form of task-oriented work possible. But it is important to remember that this does not happen automatically. In fact, the strange truth is that at the moment, this technology is used more for the intensified supervision of a worker's time through devices such as the time clock. The absurdity of this application of technology brings to my mind the educative month I spent in industrializing India. On my daily walks, I began to pay attention to Indian street sweepers who were on the corners from morning to night, but the streets never seemed to get any cleaner. When I expressed my puzzlement to an Indian friend and asked why the managers of these sweepers do not complain about the situation, he answered that I had looked at the matter from an entirely false perspective. I had assumed, erroneously, that the Indian street sweeper's task was to sweep the streets. But, he added, the Indian street sweeper's job is not to sweep the street. It is to exist impeccably in the capacity of a street sweeper. This is a good expression for the ideology that is also behind the time clock. The most refined time clocks that I have seen have dozens of codes that people are expected to use in order to indicate with which particular nuance of their impeccable existing they are engaged at any given time, including the state of their digestive system, which is the main justifier of pauses. This is time-oriented use of technology at its purest. The rhythm of creativity. One cannot deny that our management still focuses too much on the external factors of work, like the worker's time and place, instead of inciting the creativity on which the company's success depends in the information economy. Most managers have not understood the deep consequences of the question, is our purpose at work to do time or to do something? In the early 70s, Les Ernest of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at Stanford University gave a good précis of the hacker's answer to this question. We try to judge people not on how much time they waste, but on what they accomplish over fairly long periods of time, like a half year to a year. This answer can be understood both purely pragmatically or ethically. The pragmatic message is that the information economy's most important source of productivity is creativity, and it is not possible to create interesting things in a constant hurry or in a regulated manner from 9 to 5. So even for purely economic reasons, it is important to allow for playfulness and individual styles of creativity, since in the information economy, the culture of supervision turns easily against its desired objectives. Of course, an important added condition is that in the realization of the task-oriented project culture, set project schedules are not too short-term, that they are not the deadlines of the survival life, so that there is a genuine opportunity for creative rhythm. But, of course, the ethical dimension involved here is even more important than these pragmatic considerations. We are talking about a worthy life. The culture of work-time supervision is a culture that regards grown-up persons as too immature to be in charge of their lives. It assumes that there are only a few people in any given enterprise or government agency who are sufficiently mature to take responsibility for themselves, and that the majority of adults are unable to do so without continuous guidance provided by the small authority group. In such a culture, the majority of human beings finds itself condemned to obedience. Hackers have always respected the individual. They have always been anti-authoritarian. Raymond defines the hacker position. The authoritarian attitude has to be fought wherever you find it, lest it smother you and other hackers. The hacker ethic also reminds us, in the midst of all the curtailment of individual worth and freedom that goes on in the name of work, that our life is here and now. Work is a part of our continuously ongoing life, in which there must be room for other passions too. Reforming the forms of work is a matter not only of respecting the workers, but of respecting human beings as human beings. Hackers do not subscribe to the adage, "time is money," but rather to the adage, "it's my life." And certainly, this is now our life, which we must live fully, not a stripped beta version of it.